This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Okay, so we move to Steve Tomljanovich's talk. I think one of the main areas of concern in transplantation is cardiovascular disease. I always have to remind people that 40% of patients die with a functioning graft from early cardiovascular disease, and we obviously need to modify the course of this, and Steve will discuss this topic for us.
Thanks, Flavio. Let me get set up here. So Flavio sandwiched me between the science of himself and many, so for the next 30 minutes I'll be your brain sorbet to cleanse your palate. So the smart people can tell you about science. And because your cookie is kicking in and you want to fall asleep, I got a little psychedelic start. As Flavio mentioned, cardiovascular disease is something we deal with in the chronic kidney disease patients, and certainly post-transplant is a major concern that we have and how to modify it. As you know, 40% of our patients lose their graft because they die, not because their graft fails. And of those, 30% or plus 30% of them die with cardiovascular complications. Usually in the general population, it's the conventional risk factors we know about: hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, smoking, family history. And we also know that in the end-stage renal population that this risk is 10 to 20 times greater. And even after transplantation, although this risk is reduced over the dialysis population, it's still much greater than the general population. And as you all know, although we are transplanting older patients and the risks are a little bit more narrowed as you get to the older population of transplant patients and ESRD patients, where we're dealing with a disease in a really young population. So if you look at dialysis and transplant patients who are relatively young and wouldn't normally be at great risk for dying of cardiovascular complications, it's clearly a huge problem for us. So this is obviously something we've been aware of for a long, long time. There have been many, many papers, and if you look at the literature, you can read lots about it. In general, in the 30 minutes, I will try to condense what I know and what I would like to share with you, but take-home messages are it happens in a younger age. Interestingly, when you look at cardiovascular complications post-transplant, that these patients are dying of sudden and presumed arrhythmic deaths. And it's possible that this is related to left ventricular hypertrophy, myocardial fibrosis, and other issues which may lead to arrhythmic deaths rather than a traditional chest pain, heart failure, and death. So it's a different kind of presentation that we see post-transplant. And so when you think about this population, unfortunately, it makes it more complex because unlike the general population where you can look at conventional risk factors, in the ESRD population, either in dialysis and or transplant, there's other factors which may be playing a role that we have to address, and sometimes we're not able to. The other thing post-transplant is some of this cardiovascular risk may be actually underestimated because they've died of infection or they've died of malignancy, again, at greater rates than the general population. And the overall impact of cardiovascular disease may be underestimated, so that if we got better drugs and we had less infections and less malignancies post-transplant, in fact, cardiovascular disease may even play a bigger role when we think about its impact in outcomes post-transplant. So, again, just thinking about it from a standpoint of how we look at it when we're evaluating a patient and obviously when we treat the patient after the transplant is there are certain factors that are present at the time of transplant. Immunosuppression plays another role, and then afterwards there's all these factors, some of which are the typical conventional risk factors that you think about cardiovascular disease and other things that we'll talk about that are a little bit unique to the renal population. So there's, again, a lot of stuff out there. The general summary to tell you is that just looking at conventional risk factors alone doesn't explain the event rate. And that, in fact, pre-existing disease, which kind of makes sense, and our population is at high risk for anyway, is that If you've had peripheral vascular disease, coronary artery disease, cerebral vascular disease, it makes sense that those are going to be more frequent events post-transplant. And applying some of the standard things like Framingham risk scores to these populations are really not going to give you the true risk of the population. So there's been a number of different things looked at, and this group has published a method of looking at cardiovascular risk. And they published this, and they've used this calculator, and they've looked at it as a 7-year risk for either major adverse cardiac events, or what we call MACE, or risk for death. And they use these factors in their calculation. So diabetes, what their lipid is, are they a smoker, do they have pre-existing coronary disease, previous transplants, how long they're on renal replacement therapy, how good their kidney is, and how old they are. So just applying this calculator to a couple typical patients to kind of give you the magnitude of the problem is, here's your 60-year-old diabetic patient who's got a mildly elevated LDL. He used to smoke, had a history of coronary disease before his transplant, had perfectly normal kidney function, and before we transplanted him, he was on dialysis for 5 years. His 7-year risk of having MI, either a coronary intervention or cardiac death, is 100% predicted, and 32% death within 7 years from a cardiac event. If you take that same patient who's non-diabetic with the same profile, still 100% chance that he's going to have some cardiac event in 7 years. His death rate's going to be less, but still pretty profound. If you take this same person who's non-diabetic without pre-existing coronary disease, still at 7 years by this calculator, 100% chance that he'll have a cardiac event that may not lead to his death, but certainly will impact his lifespan. And a 14% chance that that person's going to die as a result of some cardiac event. A big study that was undertaken is called the Patient Outcomes in Renal Transplant, looking at about 24,000 recipients and followed them for about 5 years, looking at MACE, again, defined as either having an MI, having some form of intervention, either angioplasty or bypass, or what was considered to be cardiac death occurred in about 3% at 1 year, 5% at 3 years, and about 7.6% at 5 years. When you looked at what happened in the first year, the predominant was non-fatal MIs, but still 13% of those resulted in death. After the first year, there were less MIs, but there were more sudden cardiac deaths associated in this relatively short follow-up of a pretty large number of patients. And when they looked at the traditional modifiable factors, they didn't seem to be predictors of who was going to have these events. And again, the things that they looked at were age, male gender, history of cancer, diabetes, obesity, deceased donor transplant, and how long they're on dialysis. So that just alone, if you transplant somebody over the age of 50 or 65, you had a 5-fold increase of an event. And if you're a diabetic, it was 2-fold. And if you had 2 or more pre-existing cardiovascular risk disorders, your risk factor was 6-fold greater than the average patient. So, again, sort of the takeaway message is when you pool events, you may not be able to completely get an idea of what you're dealing with. And I'll talk a little bit more about the ALERT study. But if you break down MACE, if you look at a pooled endpoint like MACE, so that's MI, some form of intervention, or a cardiac event leading to death, is that cardiac death was associated with high systolic blood pressure, higher pulse pressure, LVH, and renal function, whereas having an MI was more associated with lipids or age or diabetes. So that if you look at pooled endpoints, specific interventions may not necessarily give you what you want to see as an outcome that you want. And it may be that certain interventions will have certain effects. And that as we, you know, the summary of this whole thing is try to do everything you can, obviously. But some of the data, when you look at just one intervention, some of what you determine from that intervention may not be, you know, the desirable outcome overall. So, again, it's sort of an atypical presentation, not the usual risk factors associated with disease. It's probable that just intervening on one of these risk factors is not going to result in a significant benefit. And in the transplant population, you can potentially have some additional areas where you may have some impact. Maybe not. Certainly time on dialysis, if you have a living donor, either doing preemptive transplant or shortening their dialysis time. We'll talk a little bit about optimization of kidney function, prevention or aggressive treatment of new onset diabetes. And obviously where you come in is when we get these patients and as we manage them on the wait list, anything you can do to reduce their risk factors and optimize their management so that you reduce their cardiovascular disease burden at the time of transplant, I believe will be beneficial to the patient in the long run. Just an idea of what's happening, just how are our patients treated after transplant, what kind of medicines they get. This port study also looked at 10 of the 14 centers and collected the data about what do clinicians do, what do transplant nephrologists, transplant surgeons do with these cardiovascular meds after surgery. And this is over 16 years, and I'm sorry, some of this is not going to show up too well. Let me go back, sorry. And on the left-hand side of the screen is 1990 and 2006, and you can see that over that 16-year period, virtually all of the so-called cardiovascular medications increased over time. The biggest factor that was increased was actually antiplatelet agents, and as most of us in this audience have been in practice since that period of time, certainly cardiac stenting has become a much more common way of treating coronary artery disease, and so the use of antiplatelet agents as they get treated while they're in chronic kidney disease is much higher, and so a lot of these patients are on antiplatelet drugs now when they weren't in the 1990s. But as you can see, virtually all of these drugs have increased over time. The other interesting thing is when you looked at this class of drugs, that what you gave the patient in the first 4 months rarely changed, that these drugs weren't added. The only exceptions to those were ACE inhibitors and statin agents were added a little bit later. So the time that you can affect things probably needs to be early, because that's the time when the patients are used to taking a lot of medications, and it's always easier to send them out of the hospital on everything and take it away. They feel, you know, good as a doctor. You go, wow, you're taking my drug away, versus convincing them to take a statin or take another blood pressure medication or take an antiplatelet agent. So the time to effectively load these patients up, if you'd like to call it that, is early on, and figure that out and start to intervene at an early stage. The other interesting thing from the study was the fact that our population, we know, has a huge cardiovascular risk, yet how the clinicians gave the drugs weren't quite what you would normally think the recommendations are. So although there was greater use of beta blockers, there was significant use in the population for these various agents, it's surprising how few actually got some of these agents that you think are either cardioprotective or intervention to lower lipids, to manage hypertension, and the sort. So it's kind of an interesting practice and something we have to look at as from our own, you know, transplant nephrology standpoint of how do we make sure that we get the patients on the right drugs and manage the risk factors. And it's interesting when the PORT study, at least, the only drug that really made a difference in the first year was the use of antiplatelet drugs as it relates to MACE. So in their study, if you just took one drug as a single agent, it probably had the greatest impact over beta blockers, over statins, over ACE inhibitors. And so a baby aspirin is probably good for everyone, maybe, or, you know, Plavix. But, you know, it's just kind of an interesting observation of a single agent maybe having a significant role if you're just talking specifically about cardiovascular disease. So let's just kind of roll through what we do. Hyperlipidemia, it's driven by steroids. The CNIs, we know, increase it, and certainly the mTOR inhibitors have a role in high levels of lipids. Kind of an interesting study looking at the combination of hyperlipidemia and the instance of rejection in the first year post-transplant and what impact that has. So that top line are the individuals who had rejection in the first year and had a total cholesterol greater than 250 and had significantly worse outcomes, either overall graft loss or immunologic graft loss. So the combination of a rejection episode, which may cause vascular injury to the graft, at a time when they have hyperlipidemia, may induce changes in the blood supply or in the blood vessels, which lead to progressive loss, whether it be immunologic or non-immunologic. One big study that was done, it's a quite old study, it was a large study, it was done and published in The Lancet, was randomizing patients, 2,000 patients, to either receive fluvastatin or placebo in a double-blind fashion, and they followed these patients for 6 years. And MACE was the endpoint, but they also looked at other events that were secondary endpoints. When you gave fluvastatin at 80 milligrams a day to these patients, you had a profound and significant drop in their total cholesterol and their LDL cholesterol, and you can see it was sustained over that six-year period. The primary endpoint of MACE, there was no difference at the end of 6 years. So whether you got fluvastatin or placebo, when you looked at the composite, again, did you have an MI, did you get a cardiac intervention, or did you have a cardiac death? No difference. When you looked at, quote-unquote, a definite MI, there was a near trend of statistical significance. When you looked at cardiac death, there was a statistical significance. And when you combined the two, there was a p-value of less than 0.005. So that although the overall endpoint, which is what the study was intended to do, didn't prove it, there were certain subgroups that seemed to benefit from the use of a statin lowering cholesterol. Now, when they took these patients at the end of 6 years, they actually put everybody on, or was willing to be put on, was put on fluvastatin. And they followed them for another 2 years. And when you put those people on fluvastatin and follow them, then the endpoint became significant, with a reduction in risk of a cardiac event of the composite endpoint down about 21%. The sobering thing about any kind of preventive therapy is you need to treat 29 people to reduce one event. And so you think about the cost, you think about the following, the people who get muscle pain, you know, the whole part of preventive care of how many people you have to vaccinate to prevent flu and how many people you have to treat to prevent an MI. It is a little daunting when you think of it in those terms. So again, in a practical way, we do fairly early statin introduction. We usually start them with a half dose because there is some drug interaction. The CNIs actually inhibit the metabolism of some of these drugs, and so for a given dose, you're probably getting twice the area under the curve and the drug exposure. And obviously, trying to get to 100 is an LDL goal and encourage that weight loss. High blood pressure. Again, systolic blood pressure and pulse pressure seem to be associated with cerebrovascular events and cardiac death. Theoretically, the goal is 130 over 80. We know that if we can improve blood pressure and we have normalization of renal function with a transplant, that we can actually improve left ventricular hypertrophy. And using various agents, we can lower proteinuria, which probably are surrogate markers for progression of risk of cardiovascular disease. Generally, the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers have been shown to protect against vasoconstriction. The ACE and ARBs have mixed results. Clearly, beta blockers, as you saw from the PORT study, is a very high use, and with the pre-existing cardiac disease, tends to be a common combo drug that we use with our patients. This is a systematic review using the Cochrane methodology, and these authors looked at 60 trials that had enrolled 3,800 patients. 29 trials looked at calcium channel blocker versus placebo, 10 trials with ACE inhibitors versus placebo, and 7 trials with ACE compared to calcium channel blockers. Just to kind of hone in on graft loss, looking at these various studies and combining them under the Cochrane methodology, is that if you compared calcium channel blocker to placebo, you reduce their risk of graft loss by about 25%, and that was statistically significant. Calcium channel blockers versus ACE inhibitors, you reduced it to some degree, but it wasn't statistically significant. As you can imagine, GFR difference actually improved GFR when you gave somebody a calcium channel blocker compared to placebo, and you significantly had higher GFRs when you used it compared to ACE inhibitors. So, again, looking at these things either in terms of renal function or graft loss, clearly these agents do have impact on outcomes, and you have to think about it carefully when you treat these patients. We usually start with amlodipine or nifedipine. We liberally use ACE and ARBs beyond a month. You obviously got to watch their creatinine, you watch their potassium, and they do get some induced anemia. Beta blockers are a common group of drugs that we use. And really what you want to do is do whatever it takes to get the goal if it's safe and tolerable. Diabetes is really a major problem we have, not only in the pre-transplant world, but post. And developing new onset diabetes really doubles the all-cause mortality and triples the cardiovascular events. So it's really as bad as somebody who's been a diabetic prior to the transplant. And in fact, beyond a year, diabetes is actually more important than acute rejection in terms of patient survival. Just want to show you the difference of cardiovascular events in that top line. That's people with normal glycemia. The middle line is those individuals with impaired fasting glucose and those individuals who have met the diagnosis of post-transplant diabetes, looking at the proportion of freedom from cardiovascular disease. So certainly NODAT is significantly a problem, but even impaired fasting glucose implies an increased risk for developing cardiovascular disease, and I think we have to be conscious and pretty aggressive at even treating this population of patients. I think we tend to not be as aggressive when we get their fasting blood sugars on their panel and just talk about it, but don't aggressively treat it. Clearly, there is a group of patients that you can identify, older male, black or Hispanic race, obviously history of family, history of diabetes, the obese patients. There is a socioeconomic disposition. And after transplant, if you're seeing glucose intolerance, it's going to be a problem, obviously weight gain and obesity. The use of steroids, and clearly tacrolimus has more profound effect than cyclosporin on new onset diabetes. This is sort of looking at all the factors you think about from a cardiovascular risk factor, but when on the far right side, you'll see the NODAT. I think tacrolimus and the corticosteroids have the biggest impact on this problem. So what do we do? 95% of our patients are tacrolimus-based. We do use cyclosporin in certain circumstances, but it isn't a common thing that we do. We, in selected patients, we do avoid corticosteroids. We have considered switching CNIs to mTOR inhibitors, and we've showed you a lot, and I'm going to show you some more data about what Bella does to the metabolic profile. This is just looking at a study of patients before steroid withdrawal and then after tacrolimus reduction on three different factors, the top line being insulin resistance, the middle triangles being the sensitivity to insulin, and then finally the bottom area is stimulated insulin production. So you can see that steroid withdrawal probably increases your sensitivity and improves your insulin resistance, but reducing your tacrolimus really allows that beta cell to start making insulin. And so, again, looking at these factors, each one of them play a role in improving glucose homeostasis in a different mechanism. Early identification, obviously education, start the drugs early, at least orally, get them into a diabetic teaching program because a lot of these patients don't even think about diet, exercise, and carb counting. It's a tough population. It's old that may not be motivated, and it's really a struggle to get them educated to really be part and parcel of that. Start insulin when you can, and then maybe consider our job is to think about immunosuppression switch. Let me just talk about some of the other areas. Switching cyclosporin to tacrolimus for hyperlipidemia is about the same as throwing in 10 milligrams of atorvastatin. So that reason alone probably isn't a reason. I do think steroid withdrawal avoidance clearly has some effects on diabetes, hyperlipidemia, weight gain, and clearly has some effects on bone metabolism. And if you look at one drug that can do it all, Bella, which we've been talking about at this meeting, is at least half of the 20 years we've been here. We may have seen this before. I'll repeat it just to show you kind of a dramatic thing. When this was looking at baseline and out to 1 year, the difference in systolic blood pressure in the benefit study were those people who got standard criteria donors or living donors. The benefit extend was in those people getting ECD-type kidneys. And certainly in those situations, we had two different dosings of Bela compared to cyclosporin, and clearly had a much better benefit in terms of systolic and diastolic blood pressure improvement when patients were randomized to the belatacept arm. When you looked at NODAT, it was really half the incidence. So 10% of patients on cyclosporin developed new onset diabetes in the first year, and only 5% in the belatacept arms. And cholesterol, although all patients' cholesterol went up, it went up to a significantly lower degree in the belatacept-treated patients, whether it be total cholesterol, LDL, and it didn't seem to adversely impact HDL cholesterol. It had a pretty profound effect on triglycerides. So, again, if you're looking at one magic drug that might look at all these sort of factors that you think about in the metabolic syndrome, Bela kind of fits that ticket. Now, the question is, does it mean anything? Well, taking that cardiovascular risk calculator and applying what happened at 1 year and taking those same factors, inputting it, what would be the expected outcome of MACE in the patients who were either randomized to belatacept or to cyclosporin? And you can see a significant reduction, at least if you use that calculator, in what their 7-year risk for the development of MACE in the first, comparing the two groups. So 11% versus about 14%, and 17% versus about 22% in either of the study groups. So statistically significant lowering of MACE. And when you looked at just patient mortality, all cause, doesn't matter what caused their death, if you're randomized to belatacept and applied that same cardiovascular risk calculator, you saw a significant reduction in death when patients received belatacept. What's the other stuff? You all know it. Stop smoking, lose weight, exercise, lower homocysteine levels, and finally we'll just throw in the old improve the renal function. We fight about this, about how fat is too fat to transplant, and some of us in our group say you're never too fat to get a transplant, but being too fat does have impact on outcome. Doesn't seem to be much effect early, but out at about 5 or 6 years, the lines start to vary, and certainly the obese and morbidly obese people are significantly more at risk of dying. We had a huge multi-center trial looking at high-dose folic acid along with other multivitamins. We had an idea that homocysteine had a link to cardiovascular disease, and if we simply lowered homocysteine levels, that we would reduce cardiovascular events. Unfortunately, fortunately, we were able to lower homocysteine values using 5 milligrams of folate a day, but we didn't do anything for MACE. And this may be an association of homocysteine and cardiovascular disease rather than a cause, or there may be just too much noise in the background to really look at, again, one agent making a major impact on a pooled endpoint. Last thing about kidney function, and I'll close. This is a study that Bert Kosicki did looking at outcomes just based on GFR at a year. A little complicated slide. The middle dotted line is showing you the distribution of GFR. And the diamond area is the hazard ratio of either graft failure, death sensor graft failure, or death with function. And not surprisingly, the worse your kidney function is at a year, the more likely you're going to fail in 10 years. And your hazard ratios, once you hit a GFR below 20, your hazard ratio is 16-fold greater that you will lose your graft or die by 10 years. And so when you look at our patients coming back to you at 1 year, you can see what their creatinine is, and you can be pretty confident that you can tell whether they're at a high or low risk of having a bad event leading to their graft loss or death. And again, when you try to think about targeting your therapy, you want to look at this population and be as aggressive as you can about risk factor reduction. What can we do from an immunosuppression standpoint? Either we never give a CNI, take it away, or minimize it if you believe that CNIs have negative impact on renal function. I'll just show you a couple studies. There's been a lot of stuff using mTOR inhibitors, sirolimus being the parent compound and everolimus being the newer version of that drug and the kinder, gentler mTOR inhibitor. We did late conversions. Convert showed us that if your GFR is less than 40 and you have proteinuria, do not convert because the outcomes are worse. So changing late with an mTOR inhibitor, taking away a CNI and adding an mTOR inhibitor, if your GFR was low or you had proteinuria at the time of conversion, actually accelerated graft loss. So you don't want to do that in an impaired kidney. Early conversions, I'll show you just one study. It's called the Spare the Nephron trial, where at 3 months, patients who were on either cyclosporin or tacrolimus paired with MPA product were randomly switched over to sirolimus. And what we found is that those patients who at 3 months and then at 12 months, patients who went to the sirolimus arm of the therapy and the CNI drug was removed, that they had improvement of GFR at 1 year. Excuse me. And it was significantly higher than either cyclosporin or tacrolimus-treated patients. And then when we looked at the 2-year outcome, that there was an improvement in renal function to a greater degree, either as measured by GFR or percent of change from baseline GFR being that GFR at 3 months when the patient was started or randomized into the trial. So seemingly not a bad strategy for individuals who may be at low risk for rejection and you feel like they can switch over. And again, if you're thinking just simply about improving renal function, one strategy. Currently, we're going to be enrolling a study looking at using very low-dose CNI from the beginning, pairing it with everolimus and comparing it to a CNI with an MPA product. This study precursor, we got data looking at 2 different doses of everolimus and showing that the people who got 1.5 milligrams of everolimus had better GFR preservation, so that yellow bar is how many at 1 month had a GFR greater than 60 that still had it at a year was greater in the everolimus arm. And those individuals who at 1 month had less than 60 GFR, there was a greater percentage of them had GFR greater than 60 at 12 months. So suggesting that if you can safely use everolimus with a low-dose CNI, you're going to be able to preserve renal function or actually improve renal function. And the percentage of people who actually had worse GFRs was always better in the patients who were randomized to the 1.5 milligram dose of everolimus. Flavio's shown you this slide many times. This is the mean GFR of patients in the benefits study. And 2 things that we always point out. One, always the belatacept-treated patients have a higher GFR. But more importantly, the slope of that line is positive in the patients on belatacept, and it's negative in those people randomized to cyclosporin, suggesting as you follow these patients over the years that there's going to be further decline in GFR. So again, belatacept may have a role if it's safe and done the right way and minimize rejection rates, that preservation or improvement of renal function will be sustained with this product. So the problem we don't have in the literature, we don't have to know, is we can lower renal function. But we don't know if by lowering renal function we're actually going to be able to reduce cardiovascular events. It hasn't been proven yet. The data suggests it should. The linkage should be there. But again, is it an association or is it causation? I don't think we're there yet. So to finish, although the message is there may be a restricted benefit of sort of standard intervention, things that we're all used to doing in primary care, there's still efforts that need to be made in that area. We need to continue to lower lipids. We need to control blood pressure. We try to treat or avoid diabetes. And we need to do this early, even before transplant. And then obviously on our role, we need to continue to work on strategies to get the best immunosuppression that has the least impact on renal function and preserve that renal function over the long term. So I will close there. And I have the microphone, so I will just want to say a couple words. It's been 30 years. It's been a great ride. I've known you for many, many years. I want to thank you for not only your support of me, our program. I work with a lot of great people. I think together we've done a lot of good work. Still a lot to be done. I got a lot of people to follow and pick up what I've done, and just want to thank you for supporting our program, taking care of our patients together, and I'll have a glass of wine later. Take care. Thanks. That's one way to get out of question and answer period. I'll move along. Oh, I'm sorry. Go, Paul. I'll give you one.
That's an outstanding thing. The question is, those of us taking care of dialysis patients, should we treat those on the transplant waiting list differently than those who are not? You know, an example would be like statins. I know there's no recommendation. However, based upon the alert data you showed, those who are on waiting list, should they be on a statin?
I think that you know, certainly you as practicing nephrologist, at least probably all of us look at KDIGO and sort of guidelines for CKD and ESRD. There's never been a study that have shown that those kinds of interventions collectively have been looked at in a systematic way once they receive a transplant. So I don't think we have any. I don't have any data when I look at the literature to know. I think the problem that we have is two things. Intuitively, it always makes sense. Blood pressure better, cholesterol better, they're not fat, they don't smoke. You know, those things intuitively would make sense to try to do. But the barriers that we have, and certainly you have in a dialysis population where volume removal and hypertension management and, you know, some of these factors are not simplistic, and sometimes in our efforts to reduce these factors, and then you go back and look at the data, you actually reduce or increase morbidity and mortality, you know, too much EPO. I mean, you know, we've been there in this sort of population that has so many factors that has impact on outcome. I guess my message, if I were to say any message, is, like John started this, send them to us early, and let's get them a living donor or get them transplanted as soon as we can. I think that's kind of my best message, knowing that all these other efforts are going to be, you know, very problematic and difficult to actually achieve, not to say we shouldn't try. Yes, Jay.
You mentioned that new onset diabetes mellitus after transplantation is almost as bad as patients being diabetic. Are there any data, published data on that? And I'm wondering what's the mechanism, why new onset diabetes would be as bad as being diabetic for years?
Flavio, you want to answer that one? He's the diabetes man. I mean, there's associated data. So there's actually published data that looks at it and then looks at outcomes. So, and then if you do multivariate analysis, it still holds up as a risk factor. And again, I didn't have time in 30 minutes to kind of expound on a lot of this stuff. It's certainly associated with poor outcomes. Mechanistically, I'm not sure I understand it, but clearly hyperglycemia, just like that slide I showed you just with hyperlipidemia and rejection, so it may be a cofactor that accelerates cardiovascular disease when these other factors are present, hypertension, rejection, hyperlipidemia. So I'll kind of use that, but, you know, he's the guy that probably knows more about this than I do.
What? I agree with what Steve said. I think there is some in vitro data that suggests that hyperglycemia increases some of the kinase, for example, AKT, PI3K, and so on. And so maybe this is one mechanism that may lead to sort of accelerated atherosclerosis and morbid events. With Zoltan Lasek, we've had some grants where we've looked at these kinases actually within the kidneys of patients who develop NODAT, and we could not actually determine that they were more upregulated. But the in vitro data does suggest that. So there are two things about hyperglycemia. One, it does increase independently the risk for graft failure. But there is a more pronounced effect on patient deaths. Specific, as Steve said, the specific mechanism by which it does that, we really don't know.
Yes. Oh, Marcia, are you here? Did you hear that question? Have we the cardiovascular risks in pediatric or adolescent kids? Is there any data? I haven't looked at the pediatric data, but do you have anything to share?
There's not much literature to guide treatment of hyperlipidemia in adolescents or children.
Could you repeat it?
Yeah, I'll tell you.
To know what to do.
Okay, so not a lot out there. There's not a lot of guidelines, especially for things like hyperlipidemia, about how do you treat it. And again, remember, one of the problems is that, although I showed you that graph, the event rate is really small. It's 20-fold greater, 50-fold greater, but still the number of events that are happening in that young population is relatively small, even though the magnitude of difference is so much greater than the general population. So some of it has to do with just the volume of pediatric patients that are transplanted and the ability to follow them into, you know, adulthood. But you would think that the same kind of factors hold true. Great. Yes, Dr. Ram.
What the VADT and the CART files have shown that we control children in greater cardiovascular death as high as 22%, and the trials were actually stopped and terminated. With the transplant patient for
Well, again, we know that those drugs increase hyperglycemic risk, and certainly in specific subpopulations are at higher risk. So, again, looking at CNIs and steroids, you have to take it in the context of what their needs are for immunosuppression as well. So I think some of it is easy to say you can convert them, but based on immunologic risk and other factors, that may not be possible, and you're going to have to modulate the other factors if you can't do those, you know, maneuvers.
Why do you think there's no reduced risk in the belacept versus the CNI regimens for new onset diabetes?
No, I'm sorry. There's a 50% reduction. Right. So the incidence in the first year is 5% in the belatacept-treated patients and 10% in the cyclosporin-treated patients. It was significantly different. I'm sorry. But that slide showed a 50% reduction. So generally what we think about, cyclosporin is about 10% of the population get new-onset diabetes. Cyclosporin-treated, tacrolimus treated about 20%, and Bela is about 5%. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.